Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Hindu Studies podcast, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Leah Como, who's Associate Professor of Religion at the University of Sciences in Philadelphia. We're talking about a really fascinating, rich read, material devotion in a South Indian poetic world. Hello, good morning, Leah. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. One might say it's my dharma, apparently. Just prior to us hitting record, you were saying something really fascinating, and I thought, we better get this on the air. What were you saying? I interrupted you, actually.
I was mentioning how, you know, I always see these calls for digital humanities and how we need to capture oral narratives and people's stories, and we're always trying to do it retroactively, and that this series of the New Books in Hindu Studies is actually it shows that Raj has foresight and that he's collecting these, you know, he's creating a corpus or, you know, a digital corpus, really a library, and it will become a scholarly anthology. If it isn't already, I mean, it already is. I mean, we're listening to it as it is built, but
yes.
That's really what we're building here.
That's so fascinating. You know, much like the age that we're living through, the epoch, the turn of the epoch that we're living through, we're not going to begin to understand 2020 for 100 years. We can see it, but there's so much happening with online education, with the humanities, with the world, with structures. And it's similar to this podcast. I have no idea how I got roped into this. I'm very thankful that I did agree to do this service. I think I did all three podcasts in all of 2018 when I started. And I've probably done about, you know, close to 50 in this year alone, 2020, it's grown. And I'm really surprised. I really, really am surprised at the diversity of listeners, because Generally it's pitched towards a public audience, right? It's pitched towards people who are interested in continuing studies crowd, you know, heritage learners and the like. And yet our specialist colleagues listen in. And I'm thinking, like, isn't this boring them? But I don't know. It's sort of, I think it's a great way to vet the book for their own research and teaching. But it really feels to me like it's becoming a thing. It's becoming a community. Like, I'm on the other side of it, so I don't really engage people who listen to the podcast. Mm-hmm. But it feels to me like it's now a thing, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a clean forum for hearing the notes of the book, right? I mean, it's your own book. It's a book review of your own book. And the format is so clean and efficient. I mean, why wouldn't you listen? It's such a good... it's such a resource, really.
That's fascinating.
And you can do it, you know, a lot of people have said you can do it as you're folding laundry, you can do it as you're preparing for class. I listen to it in between classes when I'm just pulling out readings and whatnot for my next class. So my hands are in teacher mode, but my brain is in research mode, and I can do that and kind of double my workload with this podcast. So it's amazing.
Yeah. There are a couple of podcasts that I listen to, and obviously they're always, you know, while walking or washing dishes or cooking or something. I never listen to this one because the perfectionist in me would not be able to sleep that night. Because this is very, it's not like this is my full-time job. This is something I fit into a number of things where, you know, it's not like I sit there and rehearse questions all night and agonize over that. So it's very off the cuff, obviously, as anybody who listens knows. Your book is so interesting. I think I want to start with a question that I usually ask later, if at all. Can you tell us what your data is? What are you looking at for your book?
Yes. The data is several things, and this is what makes the book what it is. So I'm trying to introduce this concept of the sensory corpus, and that is connecting text, a single text, if there's such a thing as a single text, all the intertextual references, and then the materiality of that text, whether it be the actual palm leaf manuscript or a mountain that is described in the literature. So all of that materiality is accumulated, and that's intentional, and that's the model of the book, is to sort of accumulate and to sort of snowball all this information together as an intellectual exercise, not as, it gives you a framework to move anecdotal, so-called anecdotal evidence from the field into an intellectual model for the study of literature. So the data is 9th century Tamil devotional poetry, sculptures and iconography, grammatical treatises, hagiographies, temple inscriptions, modern commentary, temple architecture, and then contemporary observations about the life of the poetry and everything that has come out of the life of the poetry, all put together carefully and with intentional design.
So you are looking at literature, right? You're looking at a literary work with an eye to what's happening in the world beyond that work. Would that be a fair assessment?
I'm looking at the literature and the world inside, the materiality of the world inside the literature. Again, like as they talk about mountainscapes and rushing waterways, but then also characterizing that literature as something that generates more. So whether it be the Kovai genre and all the Kovais that come after it, or whether it be a sculptural tradition, or whether it be a performative moment. So it's not just the text, but all the little ripples and butterfly effects that come out of when you compose poetry.
One of the, it's a rich read. Maybe I'll share a snippet of it. It's a very accessible sort of narrative style, really. So obviously a scholarly work, but it's a narrative style. It's a rich read. It pulls you in, and so that the style befits the content, which is wanting to pull you into a world to facilitate an experience. To my mind, one of the typologies that plays in my brain is something I think originally might be from Umberto Eco, but it was this sort of typology was put on my radar by my brilliant advisor, Beth Rollman, who put into my conscious mind something I'd internalized, which was, what I love to do is look at the world within the text. That's what I do. That's where I thrive. That's what I love to look at the narrative and understand that world and how it's functioning. And then there's the world in front of the text, right? And then there's the world behind the text. And your study so colors or even collapses that. It's fascinating. Because you're looking at the ways in which the world behind the text and in front of the text are encoded in the text, the way in which the world within the text is impacting the world in front of the text and has impacted the world behind the text. And it's so, so interesting. So my typology doesn't work with a project like yours because it's so richly interconnected. Tell us about this project. So how did you go down this path? Like, how did this come about?
Yeah, I did my dissertation at Penn, at UPenn, and it was primarily a literary and genre study at that point. And I was guided by Justin McDaniel, Daud Ali, Stephen Hopkins, and Sasha Ebling at Chicago, got me actually initially hooked into the Tiroko wire. But then after that, I was thinking about, you know, what is the book going to be and what's my contribution? And during my field work, I just had such strong impulses with experience and materiality. I wanted to include that material, and I didn't know how to include that material into an you know, how do you speak about sculpture in a study of literature? So I had to find, and I was, you know, sort of gravitating towards materiality studies and affect studies. And it was giving me, again, like scholarly language to talk about how varied the data is. And it also gives you strategies in the case of, you know, at least in my sources, we have, you know, a hagiography from the 13th century, a sculpture from the 16th century, a poem from the 8th century, and some inscriptions from somewhere in between. How do you fit those together? I can't weave, you have centuries holes worth of holes between these data points, but they're still related. They're part of something. And also not to say, you know, since the beginning of time, tamils have been this way. So how do you balance, you know, not filling in the holes, acknowledging the holes, but weaving it together in a way that's meaningful and also accepts different kinds of sources as authoritative and brings, you know, lowers the status of certain sources and raises the status of other sources. So that's, you know, that's what I was thinking about. And I have to also acknowledge two other really important influences. Before coming to Penn, I did my master's at Duke with Leela Prasad. And before that, I was at Syracuse with Ann Gold, Gail Hamner, and Tazim Kazam. And so I'm a little bit of a religionist raised by folklorists and anthropologists. So they've always encouraged me to be creative and to push boundaries and to really express, take intellectual risks. And so I had that encouragement from earlier. And also my father is a retired architect and professor of architecture. And not surprisingly, he also worked in lighting and acoustics, and he's a musician. So I, you know, I've never eaten at a restaurant and not sort of looked at the construction materials overhead and thought, you know, what kind of soundproofing have they put in? So when I went to visit these temples for the epigraphy work, I was, you know, drawn to the colors and the shapes and the sounds. I usually work in the early morning. So, you know, if you're sensitive to these things like colors and shapes, and then, you know, hanging out in a temple courtyard at sunrise is a pretty gorgeous research topic. Right. So, and that was so formative for me as I was doing the literary study. You know, this book was a chance to integrate all of those experiences and frame them in a way that might convince other people to start thinking about Hinduism and literature and South Asian religions in general from a material studies perspective. So it's, yeah, that, an invitation and sort of a, you know, a, hey, let's try, you know, let's try this. It's an experiment.
What do you find? What do you weave in your tapestry? What is your main sort of conclusion or takeaway from the book?
That's a great question. For me, the book is about religious sensations. And I want to make sure that the poetry is framed as a dynamic expression of devotion. And I like this word, it's a, the text is a cultivator of religious experience, that it's actually, it's generative. And I use here I'm very attracted to the language of affect studies. And Kathleen Stewart talks about worlding and scores and loops and trajectories. Sensory habits, that, you know, these phrases are so rich, and rhythms, refrains, intervals and duration, all of these things. So, you know, I read them in affect studies and they are so tamil poetry to me, and so very much things that I see in my work. So it's just such a convincing match for me. And so I like the idea of working with material and not having to bring it beginning to end. Very little in the world actually works that way. So the idea of intervals, things that work, and then things that get cut off or just die off, or just don't work out, that's allowed for in affect studies and actually is considered part of how things accumulate. So for me, that is the most sort of the richest piece of the work, which actually isn't mine. It's comes from affect studies, and then I integrate it into the data that I had. But that's the piece that for me is the significant work of the book.
Tell us about this Tamil poem that you study and what you learn about it.
About the Chirukkuvayar. It's fantastic. It's, you know, attributed to Manika Vasakar. He's one of the four main Shaiva Bhakti saints, one of the Nalvar. And it's 400 verses. Every verse has to mention Shiva in some fashion. It has to praise him. And it is also ahapural poetry. So it has its roots in Sangam, or, you know, classical Tamil love poetry. So we have the hero and the heroine. We have the Tinai landscapes, or the interior landscapes, as they've been made famous in Western Academy. And, you know, interestingly, Manika Bhaskar doesn't write himself into this poem all that much. Some of the other bhakti poetry, it's the poet figured as the heroine, and she, you know, laments and seeks out her desired lord. This poetry is not told in that fashion. The poet is kind of outside of the romance. And so it's a proper Sangam romance between a hero and a heroine. And then as they interact on the landscapes and they sort of lament and they chase after each other and they hide and plot to meet each other in the dark, all these things, Shiva is there in the background, or sometimes in the foreground, depending on the verse. So they walk through, you know, meeting, love at first sight. They plan with their friends and the confidant to meet. They eventually marry. And then at the end, the hero leaves the heroine, I think 93 times I counted, for various trysts and whatnot. He goes and works for the king. He goes for an education. He goes for other women who are more attractive or enticing than his wife. And then at the end, there isn't truly like an end, but you know, it ends with a meditation on the hero being respectable and he has all the riches of the supernatural world. So the poet works through all these phases of Akham love poetry, but again, the Shiva is sort of walking in the woods with them. He's pictured in the city, in 21 cities are named, where he's there dancing, or he's in the temple, or he's in the hall at Chidambaram. And it's really just every single verse of the 400 has to weave both stories together. And then there's a third plane or landscape. This is from Norman Cutler. The third sort of person in the room is the devotees, who are not in the Akham love story, and they are not gods, you know, so they're not in the same plane as Shiva and the people, the gods that he interacts with, Tirumal and Brahma and these figures. But then the devotees are there occasionally. They have melting bones. They sometimes mess up and they don't follow Shiva. And so those are the three landscapes that Manika Bhaskar designs in this poetry.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You want to tell us a little bit about the structure of the book?
Sure. The beginning of the book sets up the rules and structures of Akham literature and the Tinai, the five landscapes, and how those different pieces work. And these become, you know, at the beginning, it starts a bit technical. I tried to make it accessible, but it is a bit technical because these works do have really long histories and very tight designs. So that's the natural part of the poetry. So I tried to bring people in to some of that structure that comes with Tamil poetry. And it is also the framework that makes the Chokhovaya legible. You have to know something about that love poetry to know what makes Chokhovaya special. And these become essentially the ingredients for the sense of religion that I argue is comes out in the poetry. So once you have those inherited tropes from Akan poetry, then we go into the landscapes, and I take us to the 21 cities that Monica Vaskar actually names in the poetry, and also include the Podial Malai, which is a mountain range in South India. And I talk about some pilgrimage maps and compare some of the poetry to his contemporaries, which would be Namalvar, Devaram, and Tiruvasakam, which is attributed to Monica Vaskar as well. So usually when you get a book with Tiruvayar, and oftentimes it'll also include Tiruvasakam because it's by the same poet. So those pieces give you a sense of, you know, what were other people doing during that time, or what kind of stuff, what was he thinking about or reading, or, you know, setting other poets up to do next. So it puts it a little bit in context. And then the next chapter addresses the split between the hero, the heroine, the patron of the text, which is Varaguna, the Pandya king, and Shiva as heroes. There's two heroes in every Kovai, the hero of the love story and then the hero of the text. In this case, Shiva is the hero of the text. So I do a little bit of cataloging of just showing these are the characteristics that come out in these 400 verses. These are the things that the heroine does. These are the things that the hero does. These are Shiva's qualities. And just kind of show them back to back to see, you know, what does masculinity and femininity look like in this poem? And then I close with the palm horse ordeal, which is it's a chapter that's used in a lot of Akan poetry. So there's lots of examples of palm horse ordeals. But in this one, a horse is made out of, you know, palmyra palms, which are sharp. And then the hero is supposed to climb up on top of it and go through the village of the heroine who he loves and sort of make public his desire for her. And there's a lot of shouting and hoopla and a lot of gossip surrounding the palm horse ordeal. And this is an important motif because as he's sort of thinking about how we're going to do this, we got to get the stuff, we got to build it, we're going to make a real scene. His friend tries to dissuade him from doing the palm horse ordeal. He's like, if you do this, everyone's going to be really upset. It's going to bring so much shame and discomfort to the village. Let's think of some other thing to do. And one argument he makes to tell you not to do it is to say, you know, part of the palm horse ordeal is that you paint a picture of your beloved and you hang it up, you hold it up on a canvas so everyone knows who it is that you're there to see on your ride. And he says, you can't paint her. She's so beautiful. Her voice is like a flute. Her body movements are like a, you know, a liana or a swan. He has a couple other, she has her teeth are like pearls. So there's all these qualities that you can't capture in a painting or in a drawing. And so that's the great disservice. And so in that same verse, when he's trying to dissuade him from taking the canvas of his beloved, we also have Shiva is there, and he also can't really be captured on, you know, two-dimensional art, or, you know, it's very hard to capture the excellence of Shiva, the grace of Shiva in words or in text or in drawing, all these things. So you hear not just that you can't capture the heroine, but you also can't capture Shiva in this media. So, so that sort of takes us, starts leading us into the final section of the book, which talks again about ornamentation as pleasure filled, ornamentation as a transformative act. This is from Cynthia Packard. And I take us to a day of counting the undials and of finding honey at the top of a building, you know, in the roof of a temple. And then looking at a few examples from nature. For example, a tree that's covered in ornaments, like a woman with like beetle earrings, the honey that the lame man can't reach and he cries out for, and different color combinations between red, black, and white. And these are colors that are used in a lot of Tamil literature, not just Tirukovayar, but gets us into that final meditation of materiality, ornaments, nature, and all of this to create a landscape that's incredibly beautiful, super saturated, And then within that beautiful landscape and the emotion of the love narrative, Shiva is placed there for his own enjoyment and for his own glorification. And that's sort of the gift. That's the gift of the Kovai from Manika Vasikar to Shiva, for Shiva to dwell in this super sensory, gorgeous, gorgeous, emotional and sensual landscape. And sensual, I don't mean erotic, right? We have a lot of eroticism in bhakti poetry, but I want to be a little bit careful there and to say sensual as in there's all these
of the bells. Senses.
Exactly. So there's bells that tinkle, there's lightning that flashes, there's fabric that flows, there's smells, there's smoke to smell, there's all kinds of sensations that are worked into this poetry.
This sort of awareness or the act of being attuned to such, would you say that this is particularly important for scholars of these sorts of texts? Or would you say it's broader than that? And within the Hindu studies world, while studying Hindu texts in general, one should be attentive to aesthetic dimensions.
I think it's for everyone. Of course I do. I think it's for everyone, not just text studies. I wanted to do it in the literary world because it's so rich in this particular example. But I think material studies has something to offer Hindu studies in general. And what I find compelling about it is, as I mentioned before, it does give legitimacy and authority to sources that may otherwise not make it into the book, or that may not fit into a historical timeline, or that may complicate a picture. All of these things, it actually invites those things in. And every source does not have to be perfect or complete, a complete whole for you to present it. You're allowed to have data that is incomplete in affect studies.
Give us an example of something that you've included that may not have otherwise been included, but for this methodology. Could you give us an example?
Sure. I think the example from the counting floor. So I went to Tiruparan Kundram to check out an inscription. And when I got there, there were, 25 security guards and different executive officers there, because it was the day that they were counting the donations from all the containers within the precincts of the temple. And it was a complete surprise to me. It was a serendipitous, awesome, hey, you're doing this instead, I'll see what it is, why not? And so thankfully, they invited me. They said, if you want to sit and watch, you can. And they emptied out all of the donation containers. And in fact, I actually followed them around as they emptied them. So I never knew this because I only saw the exterior of these containers, but as they open them and unlock them, there's containers inside and they're wrapped, there's locks, padlocks that are wrapped with fabric and then sealed with wax. And then a padlock over that that's wrapped and sealed with wax. And then there's two different people from two different towns who have keys, and they have to have both keys there at that time to unlock them. I learned all of this information. And as I was thinking about ornaments and devotion and how do we give things to God, to show appreciation or to ask for a blessing, this is a model that was not even on my radar. And I happened to be there. And then they started, dumping them out. And there was mostly money, cash, just coins and paper money. But then there were tiny little tridents, which shouldn't have surprised me. But then there were some rings and pendants and like little pieces of jewelry mixed in. And like I said, I just hadn't even considered it. I had never thought, what's in those containers or how is this practice related to a larger argument about ornamentation and gift giving and presentation of beautiful things that whole thing. Where do they come from? And how did someone think, I could give X number of rupees or I could give this ring? Like, how is that decision made? How is that considered? And then the treatment of them, once they come out, they were turned over and somebody was there to basically a jeweler was there to collect those items and categorize them differently and take them away. But that entire experience completely opened up what I thought about giving things to people or giving handmade things, giving natural objects. So how would you include that in a study of 8th century Tamil literature? You know, I don't think it would fit in that kind of a study, but and also to admit, you know, that scholarship comes from human beings, right? Like individual human beings and these sort of idiosyncratic paths. And you have intellectual family trees, but you also just sort of get what you get sometimes when you're doing your research. Sometimes you just can't get the outcome that you want or that you anticipated. So again, this the study of this poetry as generative and an accumulation of knowledge and accumulation of devotion and experience and giving and proximity and materiality, it allows you to draw from that and to incorporate it into your scholarship instead of trying to block it out and say, you know, that's just some strange thing that happened on that one day. But actually say, you know, some of the things that I saw that day actually influenced how I went back and finished reading versus 200 through 250. I think it's an ethical way of reading the poetry too, to sort of admit it came from me, you know, this book came from me and I'm only one person and these are my influences. In the same way that we seek to understand what did Monty Kavasekar do with his poetry, you know, I can kind of be more open about what I was doing when I made the book, when I made my book about it. So, you know, that's attractive to me.
For me, it really bespeaks the continuity between text and context. We sort of have this sort of, not necessarily arbitrary, but ultimately artificial demarcation for the purposes of studying what we're studying. And really a text that's part of a web of culture, right? It's like studying a plant, but first uprooting it from the soil from which it draws. And it, there's really this continuity between text and context. And the more we can learn, the richer our insights into the text, the more we can learn about the culture, and arguably the more of our faculties, our human faculties, we're open to. Because these were all generated by human beings. weren't bots, you know, writing in a vacuum. They had feelings, they had lives, they had personalities and so.
Exactly. You know, there's another thing that occurred to me. I don't mean to say that, you know, when I go into India, I step into 9th century Tamil court world, right? Like things have changed. I want to fully acknowledge that. But there are, nonetheless, there are some, this is one of the reasons why I went to all 21 of this towns named, because some of the geography is there. I mean, some of them are on tops of, you know, some of the temples are on hilltops and they're very old structures. And some of them are cave temples. And that did give me, you know, I'm from Massachusetts. We don't have a lot of these like jaggery or different kinds of flowers, plant life, animal life, the sounds that animals make. You know, I don't have a lot of that soundscape before going there and experiencing it, some of that. So I do try to be careful not to say, you know, it's like stepping back in time when I go there. Obviously not. But nonetheless, like you said, there's sort of cultural refrains and, you know, there's climate and geography and landscape there that I think is significant to where the poetry came from and how it works now. You know, we can't go back and know exactly when it was written or who wrote it, but people today are still using it and it has impact, right? So I try to focus more on impact that I can see today and not try to locate or identify with specificity what the 9th century might have been. I don't want to suggest time travel, really.
You know, the example that came to mind for me when I was looking over your book, and it certainly comes to mind right now as you're describing certain sounds and wildlife. The best example I could think of as a scholar of Sanskrit narrative is in the Valmiki Ramayana, in the first book, there is a vignette whereby Valmiki literally births verse. The first verse is birthed, right? He's the Adi Kavi, he's the primordial poet. In a poetic sense, because certainly, you know, verse has been extant since the Rig Veda, but, you know, he's the first author of a poetic verse, because of an emotional experience that wells up in him because of this disdain or disgust or disturbance at the sight of a slaughtered male of a pair of crouches. There's the aesthetic dimension there. But, you know, until I read Julia Leslie's masterful article, I think it's 1998, where with her knowledge of birds, she actually makes a very convincing argument that the crouncha is this very specific species, the Sarus crane. And unless, you know, if I think in my head crane or curlew, like, you know, sure, okay, so someone, you know, someone slingshot a sparrow out of a tree and that's sad. But when you see and behold the majesty and the dignity and the stature of this bird, when you are cognizant of the ways in which they relate to each other and they pair bond, mm-hmm. when you actually behold one mourning for the loss of a mate,
right.
then the scene, it's just, we won't go back to 2,500 years ago. We don't know if there was an historical Valmiki or not, or if that was his or her name, but that knowledge of the Sarus crane, it so enriches the verse, and you so understand what Valmiki is going through by, you know, it's like the royal couple, right? It's like Rama and Sita. It's like one's wailing over the other one. And unless and until you hear the wail of the crouncha, you don't understand why it goes ma nishada. He's echoing back to the crouncha. And if you don't understand that, you're like, why on earth is this tradition celebrating this clumsy verse? Is this somehow this most important verse is very clumsy? It's not Kalidasa. Like, what's so important? He is basically echoing the sound of the Sarus. And for a textual scholar, I mean, one wouldn't typically go there. One wouldn't be studying birds and sounds of birds. But that's just an example that comes to mind that I think illumines the point you're making.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, bird falling like that is really heartbreaking. I could sort of was imagining it as you were describing it, right? And that feeling is the feeling of the poetry, right? So we need to sort of slow that material reading to really appreciate the feelings and the movement of the poetry. I also talk about movement a lot and sort of physically moving from place to place and the flicking of wings and the gushing of water. There's so much sort of crashing waves. There are so many moments of movement in this poetry that I think are really important. If you've ever been stuck in an undertow at the beach or been knocked over by water, it's extremely abrupt and disturbing. And you know, there's these massive waterfalls in Kutralum. And I actually have a photo of a Kutralum waterfall in the book, and it's extremely anemic for what a waterfall can be in Kutralum. I was just there at the season. I happened to take the photo at the season when the water was low. And so for those who are, you know, have been there and see that picture, they're going to be thinking, you know, why did she put this picture of a little trickle? But for those who haven't ever seen the waterfalls in Kutralum, maybe they will get at least some sense of the water falling through this hole in the rock. It's so beautiful. But these are other, you know, and more examples. And also sort of, this is a bit of the comedy of it, is that if you are in tune with the waterfalls in Kutralum, you will be, again, like a bit disappointed in the photo I included, but there are all these sort of little moments and gestures toward this information. Again, these are data points, right? It's not just like, oh, have you been to Kutralum and the waterfalls are beautiful. This is actually information you need to really get into the poetry. I'm hoping others will
what's
be
the,
that way.
Yeah, so speaking of others being moved in that way, and in particular, others who are scholars of Hinduism, what is your call to them? I mean, we've touched on this, but what are you inviting or calling folks to do?
I mean, I don't want to tell people who are scholars of one thing to become scholars of another thing. You know, I don't mean to prescribe, we ought to do this now. That, you know, that's not even reasonable. And also not everybody's inclined to focus on these topics. More what I'd like to do is, I suppose, two things. One is that I would like to get this poetry at the table of material studies. It's really an invitation to scholars of religion outside of Hinduism to see what is going on over here with us and the work that we're doing and to start taking this into account as we develop what material religion is and how it functions. And so I did want this work to be accessible to those people. For scholars of Hinduism, it's an invitation to start considering this kind of material culture as useful for literary studies, but also material culture for material culture. I'm not trying to sort of redesign what people are doing, but I think an awareness of materiality in the text is significant, you know, to how we read them. And I do hope that this gives an option for people who have incomplete data, or what we might conceive of as incomplete data, and start thinking about that material as complete data, or, you know, legitimate authoritative material towards our understanding of Hinduism and religion in South Asia.
Fascinating. Is there anything else about the book that you hope we touch on?
I would just like to leave on this idea of accumulated materiality, that it's not necessarily one point makes or breaks the story, but it's really this sort of overwhelming, snowballing, sort of tumbling effect. And experiencing the poetry, you know, starting at verse one and ending at verse 400 gives you a certain kind of reading of the text and a certain kind of result. It's very hard to write worlding, or the concept of worlding as something that has like trajectories and things that work and don't, and refrain and duration, these different kinds of concepts that affect time and directionality. It's very hard to write that into a text that, you know, my book is going to replicate, you know, starts on page one and ends on page whatever page. So writing about these things is kind of a trap, because it forces you to replicate the thing that you're saying maybe isn't the only way to do this. And maybe, you know, this is another reason why I like the podcast, because this is becoming a collection of oral narratives that is not text form. There's no text to this. You haven't even transcribed these conversations, right? There's literally no text to this podcast. It's amazing. What scholarship do we do that's not put into text form? So I'm still thinking about these things. I'm still thinking about in what ways has the book not actually achieved some of the things I wanted to, and in what ways is it an experiment? I hope some things catch on. I expect some people won't like some parts of it, and I'm open to that. You know, I'm curious to see what this book worlds and generates. And I'm open to it. I don't have a clear expectation, like, where it's headed or what impact it will have. And it will probably surprise you 0% that my next project is on flowers in Tamil religious culture. And so I'm having a chance to take some of these things that were so apparent and exciting to me and sort of push them to the next level in this next project.
Fantastic. Great. As I've said before on this podcast, good books are beginnings, not endings. And I say that as a fellow experimenter of innovative methodologies in studying text. And so you'll add to and start new conversations. And that's, I think, what a good book does. Thank you for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. This is great. Thank you.
Yes. So for those of you listening, well, it's great having you. We've been talking with Dr. Leah Como about her fascinating new 2020 publication as part of the Bloomsbury Studies in Material Religion called Material Devotion in a South Indian Poetic World. Until next time, stay safe, keep reading, keep listening, and keep contemplating the interplay between material culture and poetics.